Now, Wendy's been involved, as you might have read in some of the preamble advertising, with Scripture Union in her most of her working life, apart from being here in Toowoomba. She started off as a school teacher in the Ramsay Street Special School. Yeah. So she's come back, retired 5 years ago, and is now living in Centenary Heights somewhere. So back in the home territory. So I'm sure we gain an enormous amount from this life adventure that she's been on, and all those encounters she had. And let's build body with some of those stories as well. So, Wendy, welcome.
Thank you very much. Okay, I like to move around a bit. Can you hear me? No, that's not okay.
You can hear me now. Yes, so thank you, Ian, for that summary. So I was a teacher here. I taught actually in various places for 13 years, and then I joined Scripture Union. I worked for Scripture Union for 6 years in Queensland, 12 and a half years in Kenya and Africa, and the rest of the 32 years, however much that is, with Scripture Union International, but based in Brisbane most of that time. And that was never a career plan, I have to tell you. When I joined Scripture Union, I thought, well, you know, this will be 4 years, I'll go back teaching. But it wasn't like that, and I've met amazing people. So, to be honest, if anybody had told me in my first couple of years in Kenya that I would stay there for 12 and a half years, I would have packed my bags and returned home. I was so lonely, so discombobulated, so out of my comfort zone, and so slow to realise that God had not taken me to Africa for the sake of Africa. He took me to Africa for the sake of me, because there were lessons that I couldn't learn until he took away all those comfortable props, family, friends, church, all those people that I had around me all the time. And when he took me to a place where I would sit alone for many nights just with God, I could hear him saying, "Wendy, if I'm all you have, am I enough?" And he was. He is. It took me a long time to learn that. It sounds like that was, you know, a 10-minute process. It took me a long time. And it was mainly learned through people I met. Now, a week after I arrived in Kenya, I went to a children's rally. Now, children's rally means when the kids who belong to the Bible clubs in schools all come to a stadium or whatever, and they come with a press. Every club will bring a presentation. And so they'll be repeating memory verses, or they'll be singing songs, or they'll be performing a drama. They've made it all up themselves. That's the entire program. And when it's over, they all go home. Coca-Cola had provided us with Coke bottles. And I remember very clearly that one of the SU board members in Kenya was asked God when he was praying for the morning tea, that God would remove the demons from every Coke bottle and sanctify every drop. Well, I thought, that's not very SU, having been brought up in SU Queensland. Sometime later, I was at an SU camp when one of our staff members, Uncle Tom, he was conducting the campfire meeting on the last night of camp. Now, the pressure was on. Any child who hadn't had the something to get saved before the campfire was jolly well going to get saved at the campfire. Now, some of the boys had been misbehaving that morning. They'd been jumping on the camp beds. So Tom's first segue into what his talk was this. He looked around the kids at the campfire and he said, "If Jesus had come back tonight and found you jumping on the camp beds, would you have gone to heaven?" And again, I thought, that's not very SU, because I kind of imagined that Jesus might have joined them to jump on the camp beds. And I had never thought that jumping on the camp beds would determine or not determine your eternal salvation. So, seriously, it was quite a steep learning curve because I was in a different culture. It was a different human culture. It was a different scripture union culture. And while I still have some questions over some of that theology, what I was failing to realise was that the faith and the love for Jesus in the people I was working with was far greater than mine. And I had lots of lessons to learn from them. Their faith had been honed in poverty and against an understanding of ever-present spiritual warfare. We knew this all the time. So our first lesson was that my own cultural experience and yours frames our understanding of the Bible. We need to open our eyes to how other people see the Bible because they come from a different cultural experience. Now, while I'm talking, I've got some photos of kids and adults who came to trainings and a few African animals, and I'm just going to pass these around and you're just going to pass them around each other and get a taste of it. Another taste, of course, is the fabric here. Thank you very much. This one is from Ghana. And Ben's probably aren't that interested, but this one's from Ghana. This one is from Ethiopia. And this one was from a Muslim neighbour in Mombasa. I went to work in Mombasa. For all the time I was with SU Kenya. Now, this was a strange decision, because I was the only non-Swahili speaking member of staff, the others all being Kenyan, and it was the only place in Kenya where you really needed to speak Swahili. So it did make life fairly tough, and my grasp of Swahili remained fairly rudimentary through the whole time. When I first arrived in Mombasa, I would go to a head teacher of a school, and because one of our basic things was a Bible class in school. So I would say, I wonder if you've got any Christian teachers here who might be interested in running a Bible club in this school. And they said, oh yeah, we've got lots of Christian teachers, because what he meant was they're not Hindu or they're not Muslim. And it took me quite a while to realise that the word you used was saved. And everybody understood that. I could go to a Muslim head teacher and say, do you have any saved teachers at your school who might be interested in running a Bible club? And he would say, oh yes, we've got one. It's Mrs. So-and-so. So he knew the distinction. And at about the same time as I was learning this, I saw an article in the newspaper. It was a story, it was a court report, and it was a judge who had, in his summing up, in sentencing somebody, he said this, and you told the court that you are saved, but we know that this is not the kind of behaviour that we expect from a saved person. So saved Christians were known to be a different brand of Christianity. And it took me quite a while to learn that one too. It made me think too, they were really well known as saved people. If you said you were saved, that was a high bar. And I wonder, in our society, what people think of Christians who just call themselves Christians, which is perfectly fine, because that in itself says something these days, or born again, do they think, well, we're just people who go to church, or do they think they are people whose behaviour and actions actually step things up a notch? I would expect the highest standards of honesty and integrity from somebody who calls themselves a born-again or an active Christian. Now, don't get me wrong, I also learned that some people would claim to be saved because it was the inroad into churches and so on, and at the church that I attended in Nairobi, which was quite a big church, they would have PowerPoints come up, and one of the PowerPoints always said, ladies, do not put your handbags on the floor, there are thieves in the building. I don't think you probably put that on your PowerPoint on a Sunday morning. Now, of course, there is no such thing as one African culture. Kenyans, for example, and this is in my experience, tend to take decisions in a very measured manner after a long process of lengthy discussion, which I rarely got my head around. Nigerians are much more direct and animated. Life there is boisterous, loud, extravagant, and the food is very spicy, whereas Kenyan food tends to be very bland. My first boss was Kenyan, and I worked with SU Kenya for 5 years. My second boss was Nigerian, and I worked with him for 7.5 years, and it was quite a culture shift to go from one to the other, because I was never quite sure what David was meaning when we were talking about something. But with Nii, the Nigerian, he would just come in and say, "Sister, we have a problem." I kind of found that much easier to deal with. My first trip to Nigeria was eye-opening. A man called Tunde, staff worker with Scripture Union, collected me from the airport. And he explained that the chaos in Lagos could be fairly simply illustrated by one sentence. This is a city where there are 15 million people and no traffic lights. I went back a few times to Nigeria. They did get traffic lights, but nobody took any notice of them, so it didn't really matter. And there is no end of things that you can buy from a street vendor who's walking up and down the traffic when you're stuck in a traffic jam. Unless there's a government minister coming through, because I was on my way to the airport and I'm thinking, how am I going to get to the airport? Everything is completely stuck. And suddenly, somebody is bouncing off the roofs of cars with a gun, like, you know, okay, what do you call those things? But really saying, we've got somebody important in these vehicles, and suddenly a path is cleared, all the traffic starts moving, and we got to the airport.
Did you duck in behind the important person?
I wasn't driving the car, that's for sure. Nothing would persuade me to drive a car in like that. Once when I was at a roundabout on my first visit, and it was in Lagos, and it was with a man called Yinka, and we were driving around a roundabout, and I noticed that there was a man who had poles with string on it, and at the end of every string was a rat. And I said to Yinka, what's that man doing with these rats on the end of the poles? And he said, well, were they dead or alive? And I hadn't had time to decide whether the rats were dead or alive. But he said, then he went on to explain, he said, so you see, if they were dead, he was advertising that he had a really good rat poison. If they were alive, he was advertising that he had meat. You could cook these up for the stew. But he said, don't worry about it. They're field rats. They're not house rats. And I wasn't worried about it. And that night I returned to the guest house and I said,
what's the tea?
Nice stew. What is this meat in the stew? And the man beside me said, oh, this is bush meat. We just call it bush meat. It could be antelope, or we have this one called rodent. But I ate it all, I never got sick, and it was delicious. In fact, I never got sick the entire time I was in Africa, apart from a couple of bouts of malaria. And honestly, that is all due to God, because I kind of made a decision in my mind that if somebody offered me food or drink, I was not going to say no, just because I was wary of it. Usually they boiled their water, but, you know, I would just take what was given to me and God protected me. Well, then on the first trip to Nigeria, when I was leaving Nigeria, after being told that you had to be at the airport 6 hours before time and wondering why, I found out why. Because when I got to the check-in counter, I had with me, I'll try not to fall on my face. I had with me my own suitcase, and I had a suitcase that was filled with groceries that my Nigerian boss, his wife, had asked me to bring back for her Nigerian cooking. And Nini had said to me, he said, "Now, they'll tell you that you're not allowed to take this out of the country, but that's not true. You can take it out. And if they try to tell you not, you just yell at them really loudly and say, 'Are you asking me for a bribe?'" And I said, "Nee, can you honestly imagine me doing that?" Anyway, I got to the counter and I said, the man asked, "So why have you got two suitcases?" And I explained. He said, "Well, that one there, you can't take it." And I said, "Oh, so what should I do?" And he said, "Well, you could take it up to the agriculture department on the next floor up." I said, "Okay, I'll see if I can get some approval there." He said, "Well, yes, but you can't because they're not open today." I said, "Oh, okay, so what should I do?" And, you know, we were at a stalemate because I knew that I could expedite this very easily with a bribe. But I also knew that SU in Nigeria had printed a full-page thing in the national newspapers that said this: "Scripture Union Nigeria endorses these behaviours." And it was things like, "We won't give a bribe, we won't take a bribe," a whole list of things. And I thought, if that's what Scripture Union stands for in Nigeria, I cannot, in fairness to Scripture Union in Nigeria and to God, I cannot offer a bribe to this man just because he thinks he can get away with it. So I just stood there, and he stared at me, and I stared at him, and there were no phones there that you could do puzzles on, and then he dealt with a few more people. I've talked to missionaries who they took their passports away and said, at the counter, and said, $100 for each passport just to get it back. I wasn't in that situation. So finally he said, "Well, just give it to me, I'm going to have to throw it all out." I said, "Oh no, you won't have to do that. Yinka, who brought me here, is still standing there. I'll just give it to him for his wife." And he just said, "Oh, just go." So I got back to Kenya with all the groceries. But Nigeria was, it was the kind of place I loved going to. It was energetic. The Christians there are extraordinary. But I kind of paced myself. You know, you kind of knew if you're going to be there for 3 weeks, then 3 weeks and 2 days might be a little bit too long if there'd been a delay in the flights or something, because you really, I did, as a Western person, have to pace myself. People are thirsty for any kind of training or Bible teaching, and so they will sit for hours. You will be doing it from morning to night, and they just keep going and going and going, and it's hot all the time. At least it was where I was. It's not too bad when you go to the more the highland area around Jos, but that is now. When I went to Jos, it was very calm. It was sort of a place where, look at this, Muslims and Christians live together. And I had only left for about 6 weeks after my third trip, and everything blew up in Jos. And that was before Boko Haram came down. So I was going to say it's stressful. The tragedy, but also the good thing, is that people get used to it. You can't live your life on a knife-edge all the time, so people live with the kind of stress of being in Nigeria, which should be the wealthiest country in Africa because it has such oil reserves, but corruption and very poor leadership. Mainly very poor leadership is the big problem. Let's not imagine that there's no corruption here in Australia. You know, we just think, well, you know, nobody's asked me for a bribe when I wanted to get my driver's license. The corruption takes place where we don't see it, but it's just as real. And that's why I'm so impressed that SU Nigeria took that stand. If you say you're with SU, this is the standard of behaviour that everybody should expect. And again, I wondered, another lesson. Am I as bold as they are in their own culture, in recognising evil and in opposing wrongdoing, as SU in Nigeria is? Or are we just too individualistic? No, the churches, what do the churches stand for? Do people know? I'm not having a go at anybody, I'm asking myself. No? On my third visit to Nigeria, the Nigerian embassy had been temporarily closed, so I couldn't get my visa. But everybody said, and it was true, that you took your $60 and you bought it at the counter on the way in. So I arrived in, presented my $60, and the man said, "Oh, this is a very big problem." And I said, "Well, this is what I was told to do." He says, "Yeah, no, this is a very, very big problem." Then I explained that I was actually transiting, because I was going through to Chad. TV in Chad, that was in the intro, if you listened earlier. So I was going to Chad, and he said, "Well, okay, you can transit through since you're not coming out of the airport, but when you try to come back to Nigeria, this is going to be a very big problem." So I very gratefully got on the plane, went to Chad, was met by Jean-Pierre, who was the director of Scripture Union there then, and I said to him, "We are going to have to get to the US, the Nigerian embassy while I'm here, in time for them to give me a visa so that I can get back into Nigeria." He was very nonchalant about these things. "Sure, sure, we'll make that happen." And the days are ticking by, and I reminded him, and anyway, so finally we made our way to the Nigerian embassy, and I walked in. Jean-Pierre was the kind of person, he was a wheeler and dealer, so he just walked straight into the ambassador's office. I don't know, I assume he knew him, and he walked in and introduced me, and the ambassador said, "Do I know you?" And I said, no, I'm not, this is my first trip to Chad." And he said, "Yes, I saw you on TV last night." And I said, "No." And Jean-Pierre said, "Yes, you did." And it turned out that on a very slow day in Chad News, they had taken the filming of the training I was doing and showed it on Chad National TV. Now, this is interesting because it's more a Muslim country than a Christian country, but the Nigerian ambassador thought this was very interesting. He brought me in, had afternoon tea together, he stamped the visa, and I said, "Now, how much is that?" He said, no, that's gratis, it's free." So I thought, from that, the lesson here was that God really is a God of miracles, and he has a great sense of humour. Congo. Congo is another country which, like Nigeria, has huge national resources that have been squandered by a few people. Some of you may remember President Mobutu, who was finally forced to flee the country after a long time as a president. When he died, they discovered he'd amassed up to $5 billion in personal wealth, while the people and the country remain amongst the poorest in Africa. It's just tragic. My first visit to Congo was another miracle, because my seat on the flight to Kinshasa had been cancelled, but I was put on a flight the next day, which was the day when the SU National Conference for Congo began in the evening. So I thought, that's okay, we've got time. They put me on the next day's flight. The only problem is we had no way of letting the people in SU Congo know that I wasn't on the flight they expected me on, and that I was coming on another flight. We tried phoning and faxing, no mobile phones then, but we simply couldn't get through. So Nii just said to me, "What do you want to do?" And I said, in a moment of reckless faith, "I think I should go And we prayed together, and he said, I think you should too. So off I went to the airport, which would have been perfect, because I had the physical address, the geographical address of the office, so I could have got into a taxi and got somebody to take me to the airport. But the flight was delayed. So I was getting a little bit anxious when I realised that by the time I arrived, finally arrived in Kinshasa, there would not be anybody at the office. So how was I going to work around that? Because they didn't know where I was. I knew where the office was, there'd be nobody there, and what was I going to do? I didn't know where the conference was, because everything had got discombobulated because of this flight issue. So I'm standing in line, and I just happened to say to the man in front of me, who fortunately spoke English, I said, I think I might have a problem. And I explained it, and he said, there's a woman who's picking me up. Her name is Esther. And why he thought Esther might be of help, I'm not sure, but he said, we'll just see if Esther can help you. Meanwhile, you could look through the customs immigration area, through to the baggage carousel, and to all the people who were waiting. And I'm hopeful that somebody is standing there with the placard and the SU logo, which is the same all over the world. So that I'm hoping that. But there was no one. I got out and there was no one holding an SU placard. And the man introduced me to Esther. Now this is where I realised the extent of the miracle. I had to write it down. First of all, it wasn't just that Esther knew Scripture Union. It wasn't just that she knew where the Scripture Union conference was being held. It wasn't just that she offered to take me there the next morning because it was too dangerous to drive through the mountains at night. It was that she knew who I was because, completely unbeknown to me, I was going to be speaking the following week on a radio program that her husband was running. And it just so happened that she and her husband were looking after a Christian guest house just for a few days, so they had a spare bed that I could sleep in. And when I arrived the next day with Esther, they're having their Bible study and prayer, and they are praying for me. And the celebrations when we walk in, because they thought I had been kidnapped. So humble. But what I realise, you see, and it's another lesson, and it's to do with that, faith in adversity. But many people in our world, danger and uncertainty are daily companions. They live with it, and they face both with trust and prayer. And now that I'm back in a much safer, more predictable country, do I do the same? What do I expect? Oh, the government will sort that out, or, you know, I'll Google that. It's just too easy for us to see prayer and faith as our last resort, when for most Christians in Africa, it's the first resort. It's their only resort, and they use it. War is a constant in some countries. Kenya was very stable. When I would see some really frustrating things happening, like we didn't have water come through, or we never had water come through the pipes to our house in Mombasa, but you know, you had a pump that would pump it up onto the roof and it would trickle down. But for 11 weeks we got no water at all because we found out that there was a crocodile. But there was a problem with the water plant, but there were crocodiles around the place where there was a problem with the water plant, so nobody was going to tackle it. So for 11 weeks we had no water, and we only found out the reason when the water started trickling through. Now I've got to remember why I'm telling you this story. I have no idea. Oh yes, I was talking about how Kenya is a relatively stable area. I remember saying to a Kenyan friend, you know, I'm very impressed that nobody goes out onto the streets and protests. You know, nobody forms gangs just racing around trying to steal water or... And she said, no, it's because what we have seen what happened in Uganda. And everybody is trying to balance what is better. You might live with a government you know is corrupt and difficult, but peace is very, very important. Being able to live peaceably. And as I said, many parts of Africa do not. When I visited Sierra Leone, it was recovering from a civil war. Civil wars are particularly nasty, I think, because you're fighting people who, you know or you know of, because usually it's tribal. In Sierra Leone, it was just seemed particularly senseless. That's how it was described. And the rebels would come into villages and they would take the 14-year-old boys, or young boys, remove them, put them on local drugs, train them to kill, send them back into their own village to kill. So then they had no family that would accept them in the village if they tried to escape. So their only family was the rebel army. The director of Scripture Union said to me, obviously I wasn't there when this was going on, but he said to me, you know, Scripture Union used to just go into schools and we'd run Bible clubs, we'd do Bible teaching. It was quite simple. He said, now we've got in front of us 14-year-old boys who 3 months ago, a year ago, were overseeing 100 boys younger than them in an army. You know, we've got to rethink entirely what is God saying to this group of boys and to the girls who had also been taken as sex slaves. So the results of war just linger, and Scripture Union does try to adapt. But it's hard, very hard. But my first real experience of the effects of war was in Rwanda, which I visited about 12 months after it had happened. I think we're all old enough to remember Rwanda. I never saw most of the footage that you saw because I was in Mombasa. No, I was in Nairobi, but I didn't have a TV, so I didn't see it. I didn't see any of those images. It happened, you'll remember, there were between 500,000 and 1 million people killed in tribal warfare between two tribes that have been fighting for generations and centuries. There's only 6 million people in the country. And it is, which it was then, one of the most Christianized countries in Africa. So obviously I met people who were still completely traumatized. I met people in SU, Hutus, who had protected Tutsis. And then when the balance of the war changed, Tutsis, who protected Hutus, both times they had to flee for their life for protecting the so-called enemy, even though these enemies were their friends. I met Malindi, who was Rwandan, but had lived in Tanzania for years. She'd married a Tanzanian. Both of them came back as soon as they could get back after the genocide and just took in 14 children from the streets. I met a number of women who, their husbands might have been killed, but they had taken kids off the streets because they had no parents. And there were still a lot of kids on the streets. Some of them are in some of those photos, who wouldn't go into a house. It was just safer to be on the street. And I met Beatrice. Beatrice was an SU staff member. Her husband was a pastor, and as the war approached Kigali, they decided they would have to flee with their two children. They came from different tribes. That was a big issue. Although that's the tragedy of Rwanda. There was intermarriage. Tribes were not, this is a Hutu tribe and this is a Tutsi tribe. They were living around together. So they'd agreed to meet at a rendezvous point, and her husband never made it. She said, told me that she learned later he had been cut, which simply meant he'd been macheted. So she started walking, heavily pregnant, with two children, to reach her parents' village. But when she reached her parents' village, she discovered that everybody had either fled or had been killed. She and her two daughters were the only living people in the village. So she lay down with her daughters. She fed them raw potato because that's all she had, all she could find. And she just thought, well, this is the day that we will die. She gave birth to a baby boy, but he died. And by a miracle, the peacekeeping forces arrived while Beatrice and her two daughters were still alive. And by the time she got back to Kigali some months later, because you can imagine the shambolic nature of this, by the time she got back there, she discovered that her parents and five of her six brothers and sisters had been killed. She was living with her children, and she invited me over for a meal. At the farewell speech, in Rwanda, they're very big on ceremonies, and at the farewell speech, she spoke, and she said this. She said, when I was with my husband, we always had the gift of hospitality. We always had people around, always sharing meals. And when all this happened, I just thought, well, I'll never be able to do this again. But when you came round for a meal, and now I know that God has told me that gift is still there. God has answered my prayers. To be honest, I can't ever imagine being like Beatrice. Her humility, her grace, just 12 months after losing everyone dear to her. I mean, I was just completely dumbfounded. She told me much later at an SU conference that someone pointed out to her her husband's killer. He was at a Bible study group. She said, it took me a very long time to forgive him. I can't ever imagine getting to the stage where I would even want to forgive him. But I think you only learn those lessons when you're forced to. I would hope that I would have just a smidgen of Beatrice's grace. But another lesson that I often return to is this, also in Rwanda, it was at the welcome evening. The director asked me in front of everybody, just straight out, Wendy, do the people outside think we are animals? Well, did we? Why? Do we really think we're any different? Do we really think that it could never happen here? Do we really think we're more civilized? Given the same poverty, the same division, the same generational hostility, the wrong leaders, no country is immune from this. Sin is sin. That's that famous Alexander Solzhenitsyn quote about the line between good and evil goes through every human heart. I don't think I even answered the question about whether the people outside think we are animals, because I think we did. But I do remember sitting down at the SU prayer meeting. And at the SU prayer meeting that day, they were doing the Bible reading, and it was in Jeremiah. It was just that week, it was in Jeremiah. And that day, it was a chapter about God wreaking havoc on a country, about how your leaders will die, people will be forced to leave the country. And I just sat there thinking, this could be the description of Rwanda right now. thought, what are they going to say? And I wanted to jump in with something, you know, from the book of Job. You know, you've got to understand that these things happen, but it doesn't mean that you're personally responsible. But I couldn't, because every single one of them, I think there were about 14, said, this is God's message to us. We walked away from his word, and we are guilty with everybody else. We have to listen to what God is saying to us. Well, finally, a word about what is now called South Sudan. Now, I've got a South Sudanese cross here. This is what you get when you arrive in what is now South Sudan. It was then Southern Sudan. And it's made, I think, from ebony. That's what I was told. It's very typical of the area that I was in. But those of you who are at the front or even at the back, you might see something glistening in bands around that. There's one there. There's one up there. That's made, I think it's brass, but I don't know the metal, but it's made from one of the only things they have, which is
bullets,
yes, bullet casings. Because this South Sudan, and particularly the area that I was in, was, you know, a major centre for the civil war. And while they had their food, they only had food because the United Nations dropped it down to them on pallets. But they could make crosses and they could worship in the churches that they had made. And I remember talking to a man, this reminded me of the story about Corrie Ten Boom. And I talked to him about the fact that I'd seen him in church and how do you put it together with living like this? And then the story he told me that in a different war, his daughter, 11 years earlier, his daughter had been captured in a raid by a neighbouring tribe, and he didn't know to this day whether she was dead or alive. I said, how do you worship God and live with these heavy, heavy things? And he said, every morning I say to myself, God's mercies are new this morning. It's a great time in South Sudan because apart from meeting amazing people like Gideon, I went to do training for CRE, Christian Religious Education, for teachers, because they had to develop their own school system. So people were coming in to teach them maths and science and all these things. I was coming in to teach them CRE. Some of them didn't speak much English. They spoke more Spanish because they'd been trained by forces from Cuba. That's another story. Anyway, but we were living in I think it was a UN camp, but it was just dirt, and we lived in tents. And one day we got back from the training, and they said, oh, the woman who was cleaning out your tent today, she was bitten by a snake. But don't worry, it's not the snake that kills you. It's only the snake that makes you sick for 3 days. And sure enough, 3 days later, she returned. The other thing was that the latrines were on big mounds that you walked up to. There was a little sort of tent around them and you walked up. But in the middle of the night, because there's snakes everywhere, so in the middle of the night, if you wanted to go to the loo, you had to clap your hands. Everybody else knew that you were going to be okay. That's South Sudan. Well, that's a whirlwind tour. The unique gift of living in Africa. It didn't always feel like a gift. I discovered that out of my context, I can be entitled, short-tempered, demanding, racist, and wish I could ask forgiveness of all the people I hurt or offended. And do remember that the things that sound funny when I recount them were not always funny at the time. But God has been good. He continues to remind me that to whom much has been given, much is required. That's us. I try to live my life with the same commitment to building God's kingdom as those I mentioned, and with their courage and kindness, remembering just some of those lessons he's tried to teach me through many people that I've met and many people that I continue to keep in touch with. Thank you very much. I don't know if there is time for questions, but I probably overstayed my welcome.
No.
Okay. You've got questions for this short-tempered, demanding lady at all? There's an awful lot of coverage there, a lot of history, and a lot of relevance as well.
Do you think you might write a book about
that? I know, people ask me that. Because when I joined Script Union International, there are even more stories. Like Christian judge in Pakistan, fancy being able to be a Christian judge in Pakistan. And he said this to me, he said, if the good news is not good news for the children of Pakistan, it is not good news. That stays with me. What's the good news that we're... And so I don't know. I mean, maybe for my family one day, but... It's got to star not me. It's got to star the people whom I've met. They're full of, as I said, exactly that. Exactly that. Any other questions?
From time to time we hear organisations like Open Doors and Farmers of Pain,
okay, I didn't, but that's because I wasn't generally working in countries or in areas where there was an issue of persecution. I'm not saying that there wasn't individual persecution. Mombasa is largely a Muslim city. It's the second biggest city in Nairobi, but it's largely Muslim. But there was no, I mean, everybody just coexisted. But certainly, once you get into the north of Africa, very, very difficult for Christians, and increasingly difficult. You know, we're hearing the tip of the iceberg when we hear about Nigeria, but it's throughout. Yeah.
Yes, Ian, down the back. Speak up, mate.
Okay. What do you think the Western civilization is ignorant of? I think that every human being, they are people just like us. We're not superior. We've had different circumstances. We need to realize that if we were in the same circumstances as some people where there's civil war and horrific things going on, they are still people just like us. That's true for the populations of African people that you see here. They are people just like us. And I was listening to a missionary in the Middle East who we had up at St. Bart's a few weeks ago, and she said, amongst the Muslims, those ones who are religious, not radicalized, they are earnestly seeking God. They are wanting to please God. Now, I don't think that's true for most Australians. I don't think most Australians even think about God very often. So I would just say, it's easy to be critical. It's easy to say they never get ahead, and they don't, you know. But they're entrepreneurial. I mean, this cross, I love collecting crosses. They're all over my house, as Ray would tell you. This one is just made from wire. That's from Zimbabwe. This one, South Africa, a lot more sophisticated, is made from two bags, you can have a look at these later, that have been decorated. So, you know, there are people doing amazing things. There are Christians doing amazing things. Ray gave, for most people here, one of those little black and white photos that's got the list of, there's one here. It's got the list of rules. I went back to Kenya about 18 months ago and I visited, this is a homework centre for kids that has just been set up by Christians, and they wrote these rules. Be clean both inside and out. Now just think about trying this in our society. Neither look up to the rich or down to the poor. Lose if need be without squealing. Win without bragging. Always be considerate of women, children and older people. I love this. Be too brave to lie. Be too generous to cheat. And take your share of the world and let others take theirs. I reckon that's not bad. And that's what I mean. They're people like us. They're trying to bring up their kids well. And we need to do what we can to honour that and to not drag them down.
The difficulty is separating the culture that we breathe in without realising it. It points us in the wrong direction sometimes, doesn't it? Any other questions? Yeah.
Oh, Andy. I'm just a bit curious. I'd like to get your comments on the training of leaders, because I've always thought that the West keep giving money to places like Africa and even places like Papua New Guinea, but in a sense they have lots of riches themselves. It's the leadership that's the problem. I mean, and you were saying before that Rwanda was a very Christianized country, and yet they undertook the genocide. We could say the same thing about Germany, I suppose, you know, World War II. But any comments about the impact of Christianity on the leadership of the African countries, or what's missing, or whatever?
Yes, great question. It is absolutely true. I was with a group of, admittedly, SU leaders, and I said to them, and this was way back in the sort of late 1990s when HIV/AIDS was really, you know, terrifying everybody, and it is again now, by the way. But I said to them, what's the biggest problem facing Africa today? And I thought that they would say AIDS. Every single one of them said leadership. If we had better leaders, we could tackle all these other problems. And the problem, I had another African say, you've got to understand that in Africa, you have to, there will always be some nepotism. The feeling is that if the president can't look after his own family back in the village and buy them Mercedes and whatever they need, then how's he going to look after the country? Now, we think that's crazy. Maybe it's not. But it's got out of hand because, of course, there's access to huge wealth that was never in Africa before. So I don't have an easy answer, but I do think, I remember listening to something about the Pacific Islands just a couple of months ago, and it was about, you know, China is jostling for position, we're doing stuff, and one of the leaders in, I forget which Pacific Island it was, said, you see, you Australians, you come in with training programs, China builds an airport. And it's that balance, isn't it? We know, everybody knows we want leadership, but hold the temptation for the short-term solution. But it's very long-term. You know, they know how to lead. They've led their countries. I mean, colonialization brought a lot of good things, but my goodness, it did disrupt traditional patterns of leading and leadership. I don't know any more to say about that, but I do think we're naive if we think that they're not capable of leading themselves.
Any others? Right. Yeah.
Okay, so daily Bible reading guides. Yeah, Africa is probably the strongest continent for the production of daily Bible reading guides for young people in particular, as in youth, you know, sort of 14 to 20. Well, youth is everybody who's not married, in the sense that, you know, I would almost be youth because I never got married. But, you know, they have youth, adults, and they've begun fairly recently, I mean in the last 15 years or so, developing Bible reading guides for children. Because like so many of us, we came late to the significance of children in the churches.
Okay, maybe we should call it quits at that point.
Great question.
Oh, okay. Wendy, thanks for keeping us company this morning. We hope we weren't too bad company as well. In return, for a short-term tempered lady, you're pretty good. Anyway.
Not under
stress today. Well, neither are we until we go and think about what some of the things you said. Anyway, here's a little gift to you can share with your nephews and nieces, I understand. So, anyway, let's give a shout out.